surpass penetrating and perfect dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. Well, I'm glad there's nobody brand new here today, because I want to speculate or think out loud about what it is to be a human being and a bodhisattva. And I realize, you know, in the before times, a few people would come for the early part and we would have breakfast together. And often if there was something that I was sort of chewing on, I could bring it up at breakfast and we could talk about it. And that would help me think about it. So I don't have breakfast. I just have now. So here goes. We've been studying and talking about bodhisattvas from many perspectives, from the perspective of the Heart Sutra. It says that bodhisattva realizes that nothing has own being, nothing has a separate, standalone, solid self, and so on, and negates all of our ideas about how things work. No eyes, no ears, no old age and death, no ignorance, no extinction of these things. And a longer text called the Prajnaparamita in 8,000 lines. It says a bodhisattva does not see individuals, and the bodhisattva doesn't see life and death and so on. And we also know that we have to live in this world of life and death and ignorance and self-clinging. And giving substance to things that don't have it. But where's the bodhisattva then? And what I want to, I'm debating between chew on and think about or whatever, but I often, the image I like is that we have this ball and it's not like a, it's faceted, you know, it's not like a coin with, oh, there's two sides. There's lots of sides to a faceted ball. So I'm going to toss this ball around for a while. And then I hope that we'll toss it around together. The hard part is that this for me is triggered by having read a book with my book group, which is called, is a bestseller now, I think, Clara and the Sun. And it's the kind of thing that's been on Terry Gross and so on, too. So even if you haven't read it, it's hard to escape it. And Clara is, I don't know if you'd call her a robot exactly, but a creature of artificial intelligence. But she's made to be, they're called in the book, is by Ishiguro, and the guy that wrote The Remains of the Day. At any rate, they're called AFs, artificial friends. And so they're meant to be companions to teenagers, and they're sold in stores. And they have, they just look like, they look like teenagers. So they're not fully grown, but they're not tiny. They're the size of a middle schooler, I guess, something like that. And they probably vary somewhat in size, and there are girl ones and boy ones. And so that's what Clara is. And she is nurtured, powered, really, I think, by the sun. I guess they all are. So they have solar batteries or something. And Clara belongs to a little girl named Josie, a young girl named Josie, and keeps her company throughout Josie's adolescence, basically, until Josie goes away to college. And Josie has, Josie's ill in some way. And I don't want to go on about it too much, because you might very well want to read it. Has anybody read it? So this makes it hard to talk about. Clara has feelings, but they're relatively rudimentary. And also she has, she lives for Josie. And once Josie buys her, then her job is to save Josie from loneliness and to serve her interests. And she does do that admirably, Clara does. And it's an interesting question. Is Clara a bodhisattva? She doesn't seem to have any self-interest. Or self-concern, or self-regard. I don't think she may worry about Josie, but she doesn't worry about herself. And she doesn't worry in the same way that we do. She's not there to serve anybody but Josie, though by extension, she wants to be helpful to Josie's family and to Josie's best friend and so on. But because they're friends of Josie, they're connected with Josie, and Josie cares about them, therefore she cares about them. And there's a question which I don't want to go into beyond that, but could Clara become a replica of Josie? And I guess some people think that might be so. But what became clear to me in the book was that I really don't believe that. I mean, it doesn't. I don't know if there are artificial intelligence people that think that robots can become human. But what is it to be human? What is it to be a person? You know, Suzuki Roshi used to say, when you are you, Zen is Zen. So there is something in us. What I don't know whether is it really inside? Is it in the relationships that we have? I don't know if we have to choose. But there is, you know, something we call heart, or I don't know about soul, or self. You know, I'm not exactly like you. I have my own karmic formations, my own history, my own experiences, my own body and mind. And they're not the same as yours. Yours are not the same as anybody else's. I keep thinking, was it Frank Sinatra? I did it my way. We have to do it our, each of us must do it our way. And yet, we relate to, we study, we inhabit the notion of a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva sticks around to be useful to other beings. And we say we vow to save all beings. And I don't think you can do that unless you can relate to other beings on this plain old day-to-day world, you know? If you really don't see individuals and things, if you really only see flow and change, sort of energy, what good are you? You can't talk to me, I can't talk to you. You couldn't hear me, I couldn't hear you. So what do we do? There is something, and maybe it's not permanent, and maybe it's not ultimately separate, and maybe it's not ultimately real or whatever, but there's something that is me and mine, that I express and I experience. And I don't believe that a machine could take that over or totally appropriate that. So for me, the question is more, how do I express this self? How do I let go of all the self-protective coverings I have? How do I let go of the fear and defensiveness that I have? Without falling into some sort of nihilism, which is, I think, just another kind of fear, probably. What does it mean to be willing to be myself? To respond and to own what's here. I'm thinking just now about Devadatta, the Buddha's, I think he was a cousin or something, or in-law, I don't know. But at any rate, he was one of the disciples, and he wound up deciding that Buddha wasn't doing it right, and that the Sangha was not strict enough, not ascetic enough. And he started complaining within the Sangha, and he wound up splitting the Sangha. And some people agreed with him, and they made factions within the wider Sangha. And eventually, the Buddha expelled him. told him to take his followers and go. And he was vilified. Was he honoring himself? Was that okay to be Devadatta in that situation? Or was he being selfish? Maybe. But the Buddha didn't hate him. He was concerned about him even and sent, I'm not sure which of his disciples, to kind of, you know, stay friends with him and sort of see how he was doing and keep an eye on him. And it didn't sound so much like spying on him as just check in on him. And in the Lotus Sutra, he talks about Devadatta and says that he's going to be a Buddha someday. And the assembly, I don't know, boos and expresses discontent at that thought. And the Buddha said, look, in past lives, it's one of the signs of a Buddha is that he can remember all the fast. She can remember all of her past lives. Anyway, it says that Devadatta was a great mentor and support on the path for the Buddha in past years. And it will become a Buddha someday. So does that mean that we should go ahead and express our, I don't know, critical nature, our selfish nature? There's not a rule about this, I don't think. There's not an answer. There's not a hard and fast answer. Devadatta needed to be Devadatta, and Devadatta accepted, or maybe didn't choose it, but you know, there suffered karmic consequences and was shunned and banished. Most of us don't have to make that kind of decision, but it's really, it's useful to consider it. Because on a smaller scale, you know, I have to cope with my unskillful actions. And I hope take responsibility. And I don't know when Devadatta got reunited or what the process was, assuming there was such a thing. 1,000 years later, I don't know. But I have to accept those parts of myself. Maybe, you know, sometimes you're being a lustful bodhisattva or a selfish bodhisattva, which is an oxymoron. It seems to me useful to have, just to have the question, you know, what is myself? Is myself my best self? Is it myself when I feel confident and relaxed and loved and able to love myself, and then skillful responses naturally flow? Is that myself? Yes. But what about the other times? The times when I don't feel loved and loving? The times when I feel reactive? Is it myself if I don't act out those things, even though their feelings arise? What about when I do act out those things? What about when I hurt other people? I think we have to live with, as human beings, we must live with this seeming contradiction that we vow to save all beings. We vow to live and grapple with the precepts for the rest of our lives. We vow to be useful. We vow to sit zazen. We vow to always know where our breath is. And we vow to be ourselves. We say, let the myriad dharmas come forth and experience themselves. But they don't come out of nowhere, and my myriad dharmas are different from yours. And I have to experience mine. And I don't always do it so skillfully. And I live with that contradiction of knowing deeply that allowing and willing and opening the hand of thought is ultimately the easiest way and the most useful way to live. And I fail all the time. And I think it's that how we cope with maybe how we cope with failing all the time that makes us bodhisattvas. And that paying attention and working with not being pulled around by our ideas and our emotions. That struggle, if you will, that's what makes us a bodhisattva, that vow. And we don't really have to decide about whether or not something like Clara could actually effectively become a human being or not. Because we have enough working with these human beings that we have right here. However, the question, the book haunts me, I'll just say that. And I look forward to anybody who reads it talking about it, because I don't want to give away more than I already have. So I hope this is useful for you. It's always weird to talk about something and try not to give it away. We need to remember that we also do have a small self. And it's really important to be willing to express it and live in it as best we can. Reb once said that it took him 40 years of zazen to be willing to be himself. So, and being Reb Anderson is not an, he's a teacher he's a former abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center. He's now a senior teacher there. At any rate, being Reb Anderson is not an easy being to be. So that's what I have to say at this point. I would really, really, really be happy to hear what you have to say, if any of this resonates with you or not. Sunny?
Good morning, everyone. It's funny, your talk was kind of what I read this morning of reading The Beginner's Mind when we woke up. And it's all about, it says, to give is non-attachment. That is just not to attach to anything, is to give. And he says, but this I, which is creating and always giving out something, is not the small I, it is the big I. Even though you do not realize the oneness of this big I with everything, when you give something, you feel good. Because of that time, you feel at one with what you are giving. This is why it feels better to give than to take. So I just found it interesting that what you spoke on is, to me, just reflecting what I just read early when I woke up.
Yeah.
The gift. So, that's all.
Lisa?
I haven't read the book, Clara and the Sun, but when you were telling the story, I thought, I don't know that that would be, like, I kept thinking that seems like it would be detrimental to was it her name, Josie? Josie, to have this being or whatever that's constantly there for her, to serve her, to help her. Like, it seems like Clara would end up, or I mean, Josie would end up becoming a brat. You know, like it seems like that the difficulty in relationships, like the places where we don't fit, is actually where the growth happens.
Yeah.
And that we need that.
Mm-hmm.
We need that difficulty and that sort of grist in the mill.
Yeah. Yeah. But Suzuki Roshi used to talk about it like being rocks in a tumbler.
Yeah. You
know, polish rocks and just let them bump up against each other.
Yeah, and you know, if everyone here was a perfect bodhisattva, I don't think I could relate to you guys.
I know. Yeah, I have to tell you, there's a song about this bodhisattva, Never Despise, that some friends of mine wrote, and lots of people really love this song. I, however, am not a fan. Because, you know, whenever he was a monk, I guess, and the other people in the community made fun of him and criticized him and so on, because he was, I guess they felt that he was holier than thou, whatever. And he would say, you may make fun of me and criticize me, but I'll never despise you. I'll never hate you. I can clearly see you'll be a bodhisattva someday. And I just think, you know, if I were acting out and somebody said that to me, I'd want to punch him in the nose. So, I don't, you know, that you have to be more skillful than that. That's not skillful to sound like a prig.
Yeah.
Anyway. I don't, in big assemblies, I don't share my feelings about it because they love it. It's a wonderful song. I just don't agree with the premise. But that's a chapter in the Lotus Sutra. The Bodhisattva never despise. Anyway, yes, thank you. Okay. Kate, then Kelly, then Zach.
Yeah, I kind of feel like what Lisa and Sunny were talking about. It's sort of like, unless I experience these things myself, how do I feel with, you know, someone? I mean, compassion is to feel. So if I don't understand what it is to hate someone or to feel deep grief when I lose someone, or great joy, you know, when I see a butterfly? I mean, how do I know? I mean, how would I understand in a way that would be useful to others? But I'm kind of been haunted by this whole AI thing myself. I mean, I haven't read a lot of science fiction, or until the last few years, actually. I've been reading more, and we watched a whole series called Westworld, which is like really takes it to the limit that, and it makes me think a lot about, I mean, part of me thinks that's our next step in evolution. You know, we'll be so bionic that, but what is that? I mean, many religions call it a soul. Mm-hmm. You know, what, there's the soul and free will, and so it's haunting. I like that word. but for me right now in this place, I think the feeling with is a huge part of my practice. I mean, and it's something that I shut down from time to time because it's too hard. Or I feel myself shut down because it feels too hard to take all of it in. I mean, when I start thinking globally is when it really kind of nails me. But anyway, that's my two cents. Thank you.
Last year I was going through this thing where I was reading all of Philip K. Dick's early short stories. And there's a great story where everyone's buying robots for their kids to take care of their kids. And they're basically nanny bots. And at night when everyone goes to sleep, the nanny bots would sneak outside and battle. And then in the morning, you'd wake up and your nanny would have like a smashed side and like a dented eye. I just thought that was a hilarious take on the robots taking care of kids idea. But mostly what I wanted to say was kind of to echo what Kate was just saying, which was that, you know, you kind of started off with this idea of like, can a robot or an AI be a bodhisattva? And my first thought was no. Because to my way of thinking, like of all of the qualities that I ascribe to a bodhisattva, like the top one is courage. Like that is what is emblematic to me of a bodhisattva. And I don't think courage can exist without vulnerability. And so if something is acting simply because that is the way it acts, because that's the way that it's programmed to act, it cannot feel, you know, shame or anxiety about what it's doing. It just does it because that's what it's, you know, the math in its head's told to do. It can't be vulnerable, and if it can't be vulnerable, it can't have courage. And to my mind, that means it can't be a bodhisattva. And that's my logic puzzle, and I'm sticking with it.
I think I'm the second oldest one here. And once in a while, I have thoughts about what am I going to do with the rest of my life? You know, it could be 20 more years, it could be a lot less, I don't know. And I kind of think of two directions. One is having a good time and buying a new camera with all the new gadgets on it, or traveling, or going to ball games and just living it up. And then the other side is, especially when I eventually do stop working, is to volunteer for things, like give. And there's some cool local charities that would be interesting to get involved in, not on the board or any of that stuff, but just somehow get involved in what they do. And so it's kind of like, do you give or do you, it's not really getting, it's like living, like busting out and just having the best time you can have with, is this a depressing thing I'm talking about? I hope not. About the rest of your life. And I think I'm more, well, first of all, my personality isn't to bust out a lot and, you know, go crazy. But I think I'm more attracted to the donating, to the giving, and we'll see what happens. But I think this sort of fits in today's discussion. I hope it's not too far out there. Thanks for listening.
I don't think you have to, find the right balance, but you don't have to choose one or the other, at least I hope not, because I am going to Spain. But you find a balance for yourself, because there needs, one of the things this little self needs is recreation or recreation. And we need time off. We need time, you know, like Kate was saying, you know, sometimes you can't always be feeling all the problems of the world. You can't always be having to be somewhere and do something. For this small self needs to sleep in occasionally. So I think it's more about finding your way of expressing. And if volunteering is what you want to do, then that is busting out too. That does give you joy. As you know, giving gives us joy. And especially when we give from that place Suzuki Roshi's talking about, from the big eye, when there's just giving. It's not, I'm giving you this. And I hope that when my birthday comes around, when it's just giving. Just give a flower on a distant mountain. Elena?
Thank you and good morning. I find that your topic is very interesting, and I would say it definitely ties into some of the stuff I've been contemplating, journaling on, and looking at within myself. I'm definitely in the same camp as what's been said regarding that. My first thoughts were, when you proposed the idea of this AI being Bodhisattva, it was like, no, that's not possible, because there, that entity is being so self-centered in its role into just taking care of this one child that I just don't see that possible. Because what's also been said is that there has to be compassion. There has to be, understanding. There has to be, understanding how other beings live in order to have that compassion and understanding. Some of the things that I've been working on, you know, and I alluded to this the other day about the negative monkey brain, is that I have to untrain myself to look at the things I do for other people, my employers, my family, that my motive behind them is not fueled by fear of not being good enough, but that I need to be doing it because it feels good and it feels right, and that I can have contentment. Exactly what you were saying this morning about sleeping in. You know, I've battled myself for years of beating myself up for not sleeping enough or sleeping too much. Because of course, if life were perfect, I could sleep for 7 hours, get up and then do a ton of work, and then maybe do something recreational at the end. But I can't do anything recreational at the end till I get all the work done. And that's the negative part of me going, well, you're not good enough unless you do X, Y, and Z. And now I'm trying to be more compassionate with myself in that it's okay for me to recreate. It's okay for me to rest. It's okay for me to give to others and to myself. That if I don't learn to give to myself, how can I learn to give to others? And so I hope that kind of, I hope that makes sense, and you guys can see how it ties up. But it makes sense in my head. Let's put it that way. So, and I just, you know, and I appreciate being able to share that because I want to be kind to myself so I can be kind to others. Am I going to become a bodhisattva in this lifetime? I don't know, but I definitely want to make, I want to take this life and have a better karma than I suspect my previous ones were. So thank you.
There's a wonderful Dogen essay on the practices of a bodhisattva, and the first one is generosity. And he says, and he quotes Buddha as saying, give yourself to yourself and others to others. That you have to take care of yourself. And that's part of the process of taking care of others. So it certainly fits. Steve?
Yes. So first of all, the first thing that came to my mind was the line in the Prajna Paramita in 8,000 lines, that this path is for heroic spirits intended. So how could somebody who simply programmed to do things for others be a heroic spirit? Be a bodhisattva. And that kind of echoes what Kelly was saying about courage and about there's a transition. There's a small self that it takes courage to let go of that small self and be a bodhisattva. And it takes courage to see beyond other people's small selves when you've made that vow to be a bodhisattva and to say, what do they really need? Or what is going on here really? So there's that. And then as we were talking, another thing came up, which is, can inanimate objects preach the Dharma? So that comes from a line of thought in Zen that even the wall and even the tree can be your teacher, and or maybe not. There's actually all kinds of like thought about that. I'm on the school of yes, and they can preach the Dharma, but I don't know how I would explain that other than to say that I've had animals all my life as pets, or well, not all my life, but at least like for the last 20 years I have, and I feel like I've learned more from them than I have from many people. Were they intentionally teaching me as bodhisattvas? They were doing their best. They were doing the best they could. If I met Clara and Clara had enough cognition to say, you know, I'm struggling with my programming. Can I, you know, how can I get beyond this struggle? I think I would then ask, how can I lose my sense that, or drop for a moment my disbelief that an AI being would have these dilemmas and would actually just be with Clara at that time and maybe learn from Clara, maybe give Clara some guidance if I could. So that's it.
John?
Hi, everybody. Good morning. When you asked that question, it kind of ruffled my feathers. It's like, no way, no way. But it's a good question to ask, because clearly it's got me thinking about, like what you said, what it means to be human, what it means to want the, if I got my way all the time, like what was said in opening, then I wouldn't understand how I am in contrast or have more struggle than I think I do. Because when I'm in my instincts, I'm always looking for comfort. I want things to be satiated. I want things to be at ease, and then I will be happy. I may not be thinking that consciously, but that's, I tend to operate that way and I can get caught in that trap. And not to say that I shouldn't strive for happiness and get my needs taken care of, but sometimes they can take me down to some bad mental neighborhoods. And I think if I had someone taking care of my needs like that, I would never know if I was in that bad neighborhood. And it would definitely be a heck of a reference point. Honestly, when I thought about it, I almost thought more like she was more of a slave. I mean, you're doing what someone else wants at all times to meet their needs. And I don't know if that's too strong of a word for this situation, or maybe I'm misunderstanding, but, you know, she didn't get a choice and to be helpful or to see that there was suffering for the world at large, or the sickness that much of us have with our karma. It was just, but if I were to back up symbolically, forgive me for free flowing thought form here for a moment. If it doesn't make sense at first, just bear with me. That if it was symbolic of the world at large, then maybe body suffer alike, but still there wasn't this choice. And I think that makes a lot of the difference. It was just this, One set of programming for another. You know, the AI was programmed by someone else who was still trapped in all that stuff too. Anyway, I hope some of that makes a little sense. I'm trying to wrap my head around your questions. Thank you.
Well, I hope some of you will read the book, because you know, I don't want to respond too much. She's not just a caregiver. She really is both. She's an artificial friend. So, anyway, I think it's a good place to stop.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are...